My name is Dr. Chris Jenkins, and I am the CEO of the Orianne Society and the host of the Snake Talk podcast, the podcast where you learn about nature's most feared, maligned, and persecuted animals. I invite you to listen to this conversation, and maybe you'll find that what you perceive as fear is actually rooted in a deep fascination. Welcome to the Snake Talk podcast. I am here today with Gauri Shankar, and I am really excited because despite, you know, having worked with snakes for many, many years in academia and the nonprofit world, all over the world, going on adventures, seeing snakes, I know some of the basic facts about king cobras. But I've seen one in a zoo. I've never encountered one. And I've just never really learned that much about this animal. So I'm really excited to have one of the world experts on this species here today on the podcast. And on top of me not knowing very little, and so this episode is going to be a real learning experience for me. This is like one of the crown jewels, if you will, in the entire world for snakes. It's one of the animals that I feel like I need to know more about. I need to get into the woods and see them myself. And so someday soon, hopefully, I will be able to do that. Well, welcome to the podcast, Gauri. How are you today?
Thank you. Thank you, Chris. It's great. Great to be online with you.
Yeah. So I always like to start the episodes by talking about how my guests ended up getting to where they are. And in particular, I always find the story of how they found their way into, you know, snakes. Because for people like us, it's a pretty normal interest, something that we love. But for a lot of people in the world, they actually see it as a fairly eccentric thing that we do. And so just curious if you could tell us a little bit about your story. How did you, you know, did this start when you were just a little kid that you got into science and snakes? Is it something that developed later in life? How did you end up sitting where you are today? And please do tell us where you're sitting today and what it is you do for a living as well.
Okay. Good. So right now I'm talking to you from Bangalore City, one of the South Indian cities. It's called Silicon Valley. Lots of software companies here. But this is the place where I grew up, born and raised. You know, it wasn't like this. Now, lots of companies, bustling town, too many vehicles, traffic jam, you know, too many people. But this wasn't like this. Bangalore City wasn't like this. This was called retirement, or people who retire, they settle down because it's a peaceful city. Lots of trees, beautiful weather. And lots of snakes. So I grew up in the city. Right from school days, I always wanted to live in a forest, rainforest. I never been to rainforest. I don't know how I dreamt about rainforest. And I had this dream of going there and settling down because I never experienced rainforest in Bangalore, right? So that was my dream. And snakes was one of those wildlife which are found right next to your house, right? And people are scared. People are very, very scared. So I've seen people killing snakes, which I wasn't happy about. And slowly, so when I was about 13 or 14 years, that was when I caught my first snake. So yes, to your answer, I started pretty early. I don't think I had any clue about snakes. And the fear, nothing. I just caught one. Luckily, it was a non-venomous snake. So I survived that part.
What species was it? Do you remember?
That was it's called Buff's type keelback, the common name. It's Amphisma stellata. That's the zoological name. A very gentle, beautiful snake. It will never bite you. It's one of the gentlest snakes. So I was lucky. I was lucky not to pick up a Soskale Viper or a Russell Viper or a Cobra hatchling or an adult one. So I was lucky to pick up a non-venomous. But eventually, I started learning about them, reading books, you know, started learning about snakes.
Right. Do you see, this is a little tangent, but I'm a huge Viper fan. I, you know, founded the Viper Specialist Group with ICN and all of that. And do you see Russell's Vipers much in your travels, or is that a snake that you don't encounter too often?
I do. Yes, we do have in Bangalore, but now they've all moved on towards the outskirts because the Bangalore, like the city, like I mentioned, it's grown up too much. So yes, we do have Russell's. We have Soskale Vipers, we have Crates, okay. We have Cobras. So we have all four venomous snakes, which contribute to 60,000 deaths in India. So I grew up with them. But I caught more Cobras than Russell's.
Yeah. So you're 13 or so, catch your first snake. So you're obviously, you know, still in school, you're still a kid. And then when did it hit you that, you know, I obviously you had a love for these places. You had this, you know, this kind of dream of the rainforest. You caught this first snake. They're one of the wildlife that you see most often. When did you, you know, think, this is something I could do for a career? So when you went to university, for example, was that your goal the whole time, or were you studying economics and then you somehow found a transition to studying snakes?
No. Right from school days, I always wanted to work with wildlife and take that as a career. But unfortunately, I'm talking about 25 years ago, you know, we didn't have Google or we didn't have exposure to this career. It's a new career. Like what I was talking about, nobody heard that before. Within our community, you know, people are, chasing being a medical doctor or an engineer or a pilot, you know. I mean, in schools, when teachers would ask you when you're in school, like, what do you want to become when you grow up? I would say, I want to be in the forest and work on wildlife. And people, my friends would laugh at me. And even teacher was confused. What do you mean? Don't you think about engineering a doctor and becoming a software engineer or something? I said, no, I want to be in the forest. So right from school days, I wanted to work or take up wildlife as my career. So I never thought about any other option or a career. I never thought about anything else. But yes, to your point that the economics accidentally, because of lack of knowledge, because of lack of guidance, I ended up taking economics, commerce, business. And then later I realized, no, I want to pursue it. I gave up my economics and good job and then worked in this field for some time at Crocodile Bank. And to experience, I learned about snakes and crocodiles and then did my master's. And then eventually now PhD. It's a very slow process.
You know, I was just saying, economics as a complete, just an example, but I didn't, that's interesting. I didn't realize that that's where you were originally. So you have that story that a lot of people have. They took one job because it's maybe socially acceptable or what you should do, and or it's how you make money and survive. And then you had this realization, like, you know, I need to have more fulfilling life. I need to do what I love. And so you go on to do a master's. And what did you work on for your master's?
I did environmental science because that's the only option I had to do. As a correspondence course, because I don't want to give up my working with snakes and go sit in a classroom for 2 years. So I took up through correspondence, the distance education. It's environmental science. And for the project, I worked on king cobras.
Excellent. And then your PhD, you started that, and we won't get into the details of what you're working on because that's going to be a big part of what we talk about later in the episode, but why don't you tell people kind of where you're sitting right now within your PhD program? Because you're at this really critical point within a PhD program, there's some real kind of important moments, and you're approaching arguably the biggest one. So where are you within your PhD program currently?
I'm almost done with my PhD. I've submitted my thesis, And I managed to publish an epic paper, manuscript, where I declare king cobra is not one species or one lineage anymore. It's four different lineages. So that was my preliminary or first paper, published paper results.
Great. And we're going to talk about that later. And I'm really happy for you that this is a big moment in your life. As you know, like I remember when I finished my PhD, it was quite a feeling. It was you hit the terminal point in your chosen field and you'll never be taking another class. And it's just it's a real turning point in one's career. So I'm happy for you. With that, do you, before we get on to talking about king cobras, do you have plans after you finish your PhD? Meaning, do you want to go into academia? Are you planning on going into, say, working with nonprofits or what's your ultimate goal, I guess, once you finish in terms of your career?
Yeah. I don't want to go into academia because I would love to work on so many species and so many places. So I don't want to commit myself to some place. But yes, immediately after my PhD is over, maybe for my postdoc or as a project, I'll be looking at the king cobra venom variation within Western Ghats, at least to develop anti-venom or their medical properties. So that will be my the project which I'm going to work on. But I have plans to work on other species like the venomous snakes in India. I would love to know their natural history. So we have close to 300 species of snakes in India, and there are about 40 species of venomous snakes. We know very, very little about that. That means the natural history data, zero. So I'm planning to implant the radio telemetry and understand them better, and if possible, mitigate the human-animal conflict, the snake bite and everything, yeah. These are the projects I'm looking at.
Yeah, that's great. Really important, obviously. As you mentioned, you really have a growing population in India, as we do around the world. And you know, so you have a lot of human-snake conflict. There's issues related to human, you know, public health, human health and snake bite. And then on top of that, you have this incredible diversity of snakes that's trying to survive in a rapidly growing population. So any information we can have to help conserve them, I would think would be very important. Let's transition. And what I'd like to do is kind of just talk everything king cobras and just kind of go through different aspects of their ecology and natural history. So again, it's a little selfish, so I can learn more, but also so our audience can just learn more about this amazing species. And then I want to, we'll kind of finish the episode by talking about your PhD work and maybe some of the work you're going into for your postdoc. So when you think king cobras, the first thing that comes to everybody's mind is simply their size. And I believe they're the longest, not the heaviest, but the longest venomous snake that we have on the planet. So could you just kind of like describe, how large these animals are and kind of what they look like? And maybe about their size, we always picture the largest king cobra you could imagine, but maybe some aspects about, do you commonly see them at that size? Or are they typically, you see them at a smaller size? Anything you can add relative to kind of how they look in that that big size component?
Sure. Yeah. I have caught close to 400 king cobras in the wild. And I would say 70% would be huge ones, like 3 meters on an average. And my maximum size would be 4 meters. So the maximum size recorded is 5 meters. So I've almost touched 5 meters. They weigh close to 10 kilograms or sometimes 12 kilograms. That's heavy for a snake and packed with venom, mm-hmm. 7 ml, 6 ml of venom. Correct. So they're quick, they're fast. Like you said, the size definitely matters. They can intimidate you or any villager, right? So They're quick. They're very, very smart. To me, working with, I've worked with other snakes as well, but I find king cobras are most intelligent species among all the snakes. I don't know about the American snakes or Australian snakes or South American or African, but I think king cobras are intelligent. They calculate their next move. They know where exactly they want to go. They think a little bit before taking the next step, you know. So this kind of intelligence in the face, the expressions, I never seen in any other snake. I have several examples like that.
I've heard that about king cobras, that they kind of look at you and you almost think that they're contemplating and thinking about their next move as opposed to just being so instinctual.
Yes.
Yeah. And we have some species like that here in the States. Not a snake, but a reptile. In the turtle world, for example, there's some species that we work with, like, for example, a wood turtle. It's a freshwater riverine turtle. And for some reason, as compared to some of the other turtle species, they kind of have that, you know, you just see what they're doing and how they react to you, and you almost get that feeling. That's fascinating. Oh, boy. And so do you, but going back to, you know, you said you've caught 400-ish king cobras. So first of all, how do you, one, find king cobras when you're doing field work, and then two, how do you actually catch them and say you need to take them back and, you know, take a genetic sample or whatever? Sure. You might be doing, how do you physically find them and handle them?
Yeah. Mostly, so we work with the local community, and we have a field station right in the middle of the forest surrounded by villages where king cobras are revered and worshipped. That's one advantage where we live. Where our field station is situated, people don't kill king cobras. So that's an advantage. I don't need to look for king cobras. Yes, if I need from in the wild, definitely the visual encounter, like I keep walking, looking for them on trees, burrows, streams, depends on the different season. In summers, I would look for them very close to the streams and water holes. In monsoon and winter, maybe the crevices, the fallen logs, wherever it's dry. But people help us a lot. If there is a king cobra in their cow shed or their agricultural land, even inside their bedrooms and bathrooms, they call us. And particularly me, I have been rescuing these king cobras. So whenever I rescue, it's good win-win situation for both king cobras as well as people. And for me as well, I get my data and people are happy because the king cobra was not killed and safely relocated. At the same time, king cobra is also survived. It need not be killed. So this way, all three of them are happy. So that's the way I work. Working with the community helps a lot. We get a lot of data from them. And yes, capture king cobras, like I mentioned, they're huge. You need a really big bag. So the first technique I use is the pipe and bag technique, which is called Anees Mohammed technique. I wanted to be popular as Anees Mohammed, one of my mentor who came up with this idea of using a PVC plastic pipe or any pipe kind of material will do. When you insert that into a bag, a snake bag, which is about 2 meters in length and 1 meter wide, and tie it as a hole, you know, the pipe will look like a burrow. When you direct the snake towards the pipe and the snake is going to look at, oh, there's a burrow, I just want to get in. When he gets in and he coils and settles down in a bag, it's a very simple, safe for snake as well as the handler. So I have introduced this and I have taught this across the world for people to use it. One of the safest method I would consider as of now. So that's the method I use to capture the snake. And DNA.
Okay, so you basically hook the snake and then you kind of move it over towards the bag, which is open, and they can see this pipe, and it, you know, simulates a burrow that they want to go into. And then you would kind of grab that junction of the snake's body where it comes out of the tube, correct?
Yeah, no, the tube, the snake goes into the bag. The tube is placed at the mouth of the bag and tied it to the pipe. So what the snake sees is just the pipe. As it enters, he will pull himself inside and coils in the bag. Then I'll remove the pipe and tie a knot. The snake is inside the bag. That's all. I don't need to.
I see. I thought you were hooking the snake into the bag, and then the tube was at the end of the bag. But the bag is tied to the end of the pipe, and the snake goes in the tube and then goes through the tube into the bag. I got you.
Yes. That's just simple genius.
I was going to say that's it. Yeah. Okay.
Yes. Excellent. The tube is just 60 centimeters. So that's it. And the bag is about 2 meters or 3 meters. So once the snake uses the pipe as a burrow and gets into the bag, and he's not going to come out. He's because he was disturbed, because I'm going to handle him or tail him with a hook. So he's disturbed. Yep. So that's a very brilliant idea. And it works. And people are using this all over the world, particularly South and Southeast Asia, for king cobras, cobras, Russells. It works for any snake for that matter.
Yeah. And it's slightly different, but that's how we handle rattlesnakes here in the U.S. Using a tube, it's slightly different, but I see that as the safest for us and the snake. I mean, we get the snake to go in the tube, and then we kind of grab the animal at the tube, and then the animal's in the tube, and then we can work with the animal, the lower part of the body, whatever we might need to do. Yeah.
I mean, you talk about the restraining tubes. Restraining tubes, yeah, similar. But here, the snake is so huge, you don't want to grab it at that moment. You know, they are really fast. So it's better to fix the bag in one end where it can go, settle down, and then you can tie a knot, remove the pipe. Yeah, even we use the restraining tubes for the medical attention if there is required. If it is required. Yes, I do that.
Okay. I've never worked with a king cobra. Never, never handled one in any form.
Come over, Chris.
I would love to. Maybe we'll do that. But I've heard, and please correct me if I'm wrong, that they're, despite being fast and, like a lot of elapids, but they're actually can be a relatively calm snake to handle. Is that true, or is that, you know, does that vary by individuals? Or
yes, absolutely. Yeah, they are very calm and composed. Like I said, they calculate and then move, and if it's absolutely necessary, they bite or they strike at you, or they're defensive. I would like to put it that way, but it differs individual or the geographical location. For example, in Western Ghats, they're very, very calm because people don't kill them. So there is a very good relationship between people and the snake. Because of the reverence, the snake is calm, people are calm, but it's not in the eastern part of India or anywhere in Southeast Asian countries. Name it Thailand or Cambodia or Malaysia, anywhere people kill them. So there, my friends who track them, if you bump into this tracked king cobra, he just takes off. Like almost 1,000 meters or 2,000 meters, because he's so scared of people. But here in Western Ghats, we follow them. The maximum distance or minimum distance would be like 5 meters. Like 5 meters, we can tail the snake. As he's moving forward, we can just follow him without radio telemetry. I followed king cobras for 4 kilometers sometimes without transmitters, physically following them. Wow. So they're so calm. Yeah. No other snake would do that.
Interesting.
I mean, yeah, quite interesting.
Yeah.
They're very calm.
So continuing with kind of how they look, as opposed, you know, then we'll get into their ecology a little. You know, I've seen a lot of pictures, obviously, of king cobras. And one thing I've noticed is that it seems like there's a fair amount of variation in the coloring among individuals. And correct me if I'm wrong on that. And this may get to your, you know, your work of you know, designating four species, but is that indeed true, that there is variation in how they look, and what does some of that variation look like?
I just wanted to take a quick break and tell you guys that snakes are one of the most persecuted groups of animals in the world. Unfortunately, most snakes that encounter people end up dead, but the Orient Society is dedicated to changing that. go to www.orian.org to learn more and join the effort to stop the persecution.
Yes, you just got to the point. Yes, they're genetically, the divergence is between 2 to 6% between these four species from Western Ghats all the way to Philippines. But morphologically, they do look a different. Let's say Western Ghats species has about 35 to 40 bands. You know, king cobras have these bands, white bands, mm-hmm. right? The lineage 2 in India, the Western Eastern Ghats, all the way to Cambodia and Philippines, this one has about 55 bands, or over 50, less than 70 bands. So I'm just giving you one strong evidence, the band pattern, right? The third species has over 70 bands, okay? The fourth one, the Luzon one, has no bands, or maybe there are bands, but it's difficult to differentiate. So you can't count those bands. So I would consider them as unbanded, zero bands. So you have lineage one, which has 35 to 40 bands. The second one has 45 to 70 bands. And the third one will have over 70 bands. And the fourth one has no bands. So that is one visually strong evidence, I would say, to differentiate them.
Yeah. Oh, interesting. So there is variation in the appearance, but it's mainly across the four species. And so probably what I've been seeing when I look at pictures is, you know, although they're all just called king cobras, what I'm actually seeing are different species of snakes that look slightly different.
So I that's one mistake a lot of people make. The king cobras look different. They look different in different season of the year. Let's say in monsoon, they look different. The same specimen, same individual will look different in summer.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So that
one more talk. I just want to talk a little bit about the threat display, because this is when people think of cobras, this is what they think about. And I actually hesitate to go here, and I'll say why, and I'll use the rattlesnakes that I work with as the example, mm-hmm. because when people picture a rattlesnake, they picture it kind of coiled up, its head raised in a defensive position, its rattle, you know, up through those coils, shaking the rattle. That's what people picture when they think of a rattlesnake. But if you think of a rattlesnake in the wild and what it normally does, that's a behavior that it would actually really rarely use. But from our human perspective, that's the picture of a rattlesnake to us. So, mm-hmm. so I don't want to it's interesting. I think with cobras, that's the image that we think of when we see a cobra is their threat display. But I'm curious if it's kind of the same, if it's something that actually in the wild, they wouldn't be doing that often. It's just how humans think of them because that's what they do when we interact with them. So I guess first, could you kind of describe how a king cobra responds when it's threatened, say by a human or a potential predator or something of that nature? And then maybe speak to that phenomenon, that social phenomenon I mentioned with rattlesnakes, but relative to cobras.
Sure. Yeah, you're absolutely right. I always try to convey this message to the people saying that, look, king cobras or any cobra, even a rattlesnake, is not going to be always in a defensive position and waiting to strike at some human being. They have better things to do, right? The king cobras, like you mentioned, it's absolutely calm. And when I've seen them crawling through the woods, and the stream and river, they're very gentle and they're just doing their business. Yes, when you bump into them, when you cross the line, when it's too close, that's when they're going to rear up and then flare their hood, which are the extended ribs, to tell or to communicate that you're crossing the line and I'm not happy about it. And if you see, cobras has such a bad reputation, but cobras and king cobras do give mock charges, like a mock strike. They don't even open their mouth when they strike. We have evidence for that. They don't even bite. the biting will be the last option for a cobra or a king cobra. So that shows how gentle they are and how they're trying their best to communicate with the person that you're crossing the line, I'm going to bite you, you know. So beyond that, what happens is if you're handling it, then you're asking for it. Otherwise, if you're a agriculturist or a farmer working in the farm, it's just an accident.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. And how, so it sounds like similar to rattlesnakes that this,
exactly,
you know, threat display or whatever, it wouldn't be the most common thing. It wouldn't, if you, a true image of a king cobra is not one of it with its, you know, flared out defensive display. It's doing other things in nature. And, but if we think about, if you take humans out of the equation and you think of, things in nature that might cause a threat to them, say in India or really across the range, what are those things, you know, say potential predators that might threaten a king cobra? Do king cobras have many predators?
Oh yes. When they're young, to go back to the questions, when I spoke about handling 400 king cobras, 70 or 80% are adults. Where are these juveniles? Where are these subadults? I never seen very, very few. Very few subadults or very, very few juveniles I've come across, I've rescued. So that means they're highly predated upon. So they live a very, very secretive life. We think they, most of these juveniles and the subadults spend more time on the trees canopy than ground, because there are mongoose, monitor lizards, birds of prey picking them up. All these are predators. So, but once they reach 2 meters or 3 meters, I don't think any mongoose or a monitor lizard can kill a king cobra. So the next bigger king cobra, the male king cobra, will be the predator. A 4 meter king cobra will be a predator to the three meter king cobras. But I've heard in Philippines, these Philippine eagles, they do pick up about almost 2 meter king cobras. They picked that up and was feeding a chick. So that is quite interesting information I got. But beyond that, I think once they reach 4 meters, I don't think so they have any other predators.
Oh, okay. Well, you got to a really interesting aspect of their ecology, and we might talk about it for a minute, but you're hinting at the king cobra's diet. And so I guess, first of all, talk to us a little bit about what king cobras eat and maybe how that changes throughout, you know, their different life stages.
Sure. King cobras are, that is why the scientific name or the zoological name says ophiophagus, right? Ophio means snake, phagus means eating in Greek. So king cobras feed on other snakes, exclusively on other snakes. They can't or they don't eat mammals like rodents or any mammal, no birds, just reptiles. So mainly snakes, occasionally monitor lizards. So their digestive system cannot digest the hair or fur or feathers. So the system can digest only the scales. That means a reptile. So they feed only on other reptiles like snakes, mostly snakes, 90% snakes, maybe 10% monitor lizards.
And is that from, you know, all from when they're, you know, hatched all the way to when they're adults, they're feeding on snakes and...
Exactly. Immediately after they're born, they feed on the smaller snakes like keelbacks, you know, other snakes which hatch at the same time. So they are perfect size for their food. So they feed right from the young ones, they feed on other snakes. That's their diet.
Okay. And then I'm assuming like, and many snakes, no matter what their diet is, you know, are like this, that the larger they get, the larger prey items they'll take. But let's say you get like a 3-4 meter king cobra. Are they focused then on eating large snakes, or will they still eat, say, some of these smaller keelbacks and other small snakes as well?
Oh, that's an interesting question you asked. Yes, we managed to monitor a king cobra for almost 11 or 12 months. So this guy would shift from larger specimen or larger snakes to the smaller snakes during monsoon. In summer, or from winter to summer, when the breeding season, he would feed on cobras and rat snakes and pythons, huge snakes. And then as soon as the monsoon hits, even the cobras and rat snakes disappear. Their movement pattern drops and they just settle down in burrows. So they, maybe the king cobra can't find them. Then he started feeding on Malabar pit vipers. Those are the very tiny, about 60 centimeters or 70 centimeter venomous snakes, pit vipers. So I'm sure they're just like a snack. Within 3 or 4 months, he ate about 26 Malabar pit vipers. So that's a good number. So wow. I'm sure the number goes up.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that gets to another question I was going to ask about their diet. And that's, you know, as ectotherms or, you know, people often hear the term cold-blooded, but as ectotherms, how often do they eat? And I'm assuming it's tightly tied to the size of those meals, but I'm assuming like other snakes, you know, they probably don't eat as much as your average citizen might think, like an endotherm, like a mammal would. But Do you have any idea how kind of frequently they feed throughout the year?
Yeah, like I mentioned, in summer or from the time about November, immediately after the monsoon, these snakes are weak because they wouldn't have fed during monsoon. So they start building their body by feeding aggressively. So I would say anywhere between 7 to 15 days, that is a week to 2 weeks, a big rat snake or a cobra would do. So constantly they start feeding, but by the time they hit the mating season, that's in the March, they cease. They don't feed because these are snake eaters. So the male is looking for the female and he's supposed to mate. He's not supposed to eat her. So I think male and female both stop feeding. They focus on breeding at that point. After that, the males settle down. So I think they just opportunistically, if they bump into a small Malabar pit viper or a trinket snake, they feed. Like you mentioned, they're ectotherms. So there is no enough sunlight in monsoon, they won't be able to digest their food. They don't get a chance to bask. So I think that time they eat very less, maybe once in a month or maybe in a week's time, maybe one or two Malabar pit viper. They are very, very tiny. Like I said, 60 centimeters is nothing for them.
Okay. Well, you know, it's interesting if people understand, you know, when I say ectotherm versus endotherm, you know, or, you know, a lot of, again, citizens think of the term warm-blooded or cold-blooded. But if you're eating ectotherms or cold-blooded animals, they have a different physiology that you know, means that oftentimes, not always, but oftentimes their body temperature is lower than we think of a human as a reference point. And then, which means a lot of their physiological processes are slower. They can control that, obviously. But what I'm getting at is venom. And as an eater of other snakes, of ectotherms, how is their venom? Is their venom adapted specially for killing other, you know, ectotherm or cold-blooded animals? And if so, how? Basically, what is their venom and how does it aid them in their specific diet?
Oh, that's interesting. But I would love to look at that aspect very soon. But a couple of my friends are working on them. I'm not sure about that. But yes, to whatever knowledge I have or information I have, yes, the venom is developed or evolved to kill cold-blooded animals like a krait or a king cobra or another king cobra or a cobra or even pythons. We were talking about the size of the prey. Anywhere between keelbacks, a king cobra can swallow a reticulated python or a Burmese python or a rock python. So the venom should be strong enough to kill the prey and help in digestion. Like you already know, the venom is a modified saliva, right? Digestive enzyme. So, but how much it affects, how it reacts to different species, I have no idea, Chris, yet. We'll be working on that soon.
And what do we know in a very high level general sense about their venom. You know, there's a lot of different venoms that affect the neurologic system of animals, that affect the blood cells, that affect the heart. You know, what do we know about their venom, again, at that highest level, and how it influences prey as well as humans?
Oh, yes. King cobra venom is neurotoxic, just like a cobra or a crate. But we also call that as a HANA toxic because it's a different genus. It doesn't fall under cobras. Naja is a different species. Ophiophagus is a different, Naja is a different genus. Ophiophagus is a different genus. So it's called a HANA toxic, mostly neurotoxic. It affects your nervous system. It shuts down your communication systems and your heart, eventually your brain. And the victim will die eventually. So anywhere between humans, people have died within 20 minutes. That's the amount of venom gets injected.
Yeah, they must have an incredible, just a physical amount of venom as well, because they're so large, I would think.
Yes. The potency is very, very low when compared to crate or cobra, but the volume is quite high.
Okay. Well, so we have, you know, one of the largest venomous snakes on the planet. We have a snake that is a top predator, meaning it is a predator of predators. Yeah. It eats other predators in the eating other snakes. And on top of that, it lives in a very dynamic climate, or at least, you know, kind of a wet, dry season climate. So a climate that changes rapidly. And so what I'm getting at is that top predators, animals that live in you know, varied environments, large animals typically, you know, really move incredible distances. If you think of something like some large predators in the world, like tigers or, you know, or mountain lions, whatever it might be, these animals often, you know, have really large home ranges and move really incredible distances. And so what do we know about king cobras and kind of how far they'll move? Do they have relatively hard, large home ranges looking for their prey? How might that change seasonally with the monsoons, those types of things?
Oh, yes. We managed to track them for some time. And what we learned, the king cobras do have a home range. They are anywhere between 4 to 6 square kilometers. So on an average, they move about 800 to 2000 meters, but it depends. In summer, yes, if they're looking for a mate or food, foraging, they move a lot. In monsoon, they don't move much. They just settle down in one place. And we also figured out they do have these permanent favorite places whenever they go through ecdysis, the shedding. So they go back to the same burrow, the one the previously they shed, right? I think it gives more of sense of security. They know this is the burrow and it also belongs to them, right? So, you know, the ecdysis process takes anywhere between 12 to 15 days. So they need a safe place. So we observed that they go back to the same burrow, like they have 4 different locations in 1 year. So constantly they move to different places and they come back to the same burrow and then shed and then move forward. It's like that. So that is quite interesting, we found.
Yeah, so they have a relatively large home range for a snake. And
oh, yes.
How does that shift with the, you know, with the rainy dry season pattern? You mentioned something you said earlier about the monsoons almost made it sound like during the monsoons that they might not be as active, you know. So does their activity change with the monsoon patterns? And then, you know, are they moving to different areas between dry and wet seasons? How does that affect their movements?
No, because if you see in a place like Agumbe, Western Ghats, and we get anywhere between 3,000 to 6,000 mm of rainfall, that's 3 to 6 meters of rainfall, and it can go up to 8 meters of rainfall, and it's wet everywhere. So there's nothing as particularly called as a dry place. So these guys, we've seen them for 20 days, 30 days, just chilling in the open rain, doing nothing, and the rain, like a lot of water on the king cobra, but he doesn't care. He doesn't care. He just sleep like that, lie down. Once in a while, maybe they go between the rocks, crevices, or a fallen log, and to avoid the direct rain. But it's not dry as such. So there's no shifting between a dry place and a wet place. But I think just under the roof, some canopy. And we've seen them on the trees while raining. So they don't shift as such. But slow and very short distance they move. Maybe if there is some disturbance.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, you've mentioned multiple times now, kind of mating. And it sounds like from what you said that it's a mating system where the males are actively searching for females. Yes. I guess my question would be, what time of year is that? Is that year round? Is it very specific time? And then, if you have males moving across the landscape, I'm assuming the males get larger than the females. And then is there any form of like combat or anything between males between males for breeding?
Yes. Very, very interesting behavior, I would say. They start anywhere between February, March, but March, April is the peak courtship period or male combat. Males fight. When I mentioned about the food and the switch between the season, by November, December, Jan, or till February, the males have to eat and build their body just like our bodybuilders, right? Because they should prepare themselves for male combat. They're very, very active, very defensive at that moment. Females don't do much because they just wait for the winner to reach her and mate. So they're just relaxed in a burrow. The males fight. Yeah, they anywhere between 45 minutes to 120 minutes, I've seen male combat happening. That's, I don't know about rattlesnake. Do they last that long? About 120 minutes, that's almost 2 hours.
Wow. I don't think that would be the case. I've only actually seen it twice in my life, and it was much, much shorter.
Yeah, exactly. Even cobras and rat snakes, I mean, not cobras don't male combat, but the rat snakes, we've seen them, but they would last about 30 minutes, 20 minutes, sometimes 45 minutes. But king cobras, we've seen close to over 60 minutes. That's a lot of energy, a lot of stamina they have. So they fight, but luckily they don't bite, they don't kill each other, they don't inject or envenomate each other. So they just wrestle among themselves, and the winner gets to go to the female and mate with her. And he stays with the female for anywhere between 30 to 40 days and keep mating with her. And eventually, when he knows the female is ready to lay eggs or the eggs have already developed, he will leave her. Because I think the cannibalistic nature comes into him in case if he delays the departure, maybe he'll start feeding on her because he's hungry already. So he will leave the female. Maybe he will have his last meal and settle down for the monsoon. But the female, she'll stay there, wait for the eggs to develop, and immediately she'll go and build a nest and lay eggs. And the viewer should know the king cobra is the only species which builds an active nest, a mound of leaf litter, which can be anywhere between 60 centimeters to 90 centimeters. That's almost close to 1 meter the height of the leaf litter, and width will be close to 2 meters. And she will collect anywhere between 5 to 6 kilos of leaf litter to build a nest. Hmm. And lay eggs inside the nest.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I want to talk about that. But before we leave the combat, so the combat I've seen has been with rattlesnakes. And cobras have, it sounds like, a very similar combat. They're not biting each other. They're kind of entwining and wrestling. Mm-hmm. One thing that's interesting with rattlesnakes that we have is that the females store the sperm sometimes over multiple years. And then so there's this potential for multiple paternity or, you know, multiple fathers in a single litter of rattlesnakes. Is there any evidence for that in cobras where you can actually have multiple males that are kind of the father of a clutch? Or is it usually one father, one mother?
Thank you for listening to Snake Talk. If you like what you've heard on this podcast, you can help us by subscribing and leaving us a 5-star rating. Also, if you have any comments or suggestions, be sure to leave us a review.
Oh, no, I think they're polygamous. They mate with multiple males and multiple females. That is for sure. But we don't have any evidence for the sperm storage, like your turtles or your rattlesnakes. We have no data on that aspect. For king cobras, I'm not sure about other snakes in India. But for king cobras, I don't think so. They store sperm as of now, whatever the captive data we have.
Yeah. Okay. So back to the nest. So the female, this is a very unique and fascinating behavior among snakes. And so the female, I'm assuming she physically uses her body to kind of gather yes. the leaves into a pile. And then, and she doesn't, does she lay the eggs first and then pile the leaves around them? Or does she build the nest and then go into the leaves and lay the eggs? Do you know how that works?
Oh, yes. I think I'm one of those guys who have seen over 50 or 60 king cobra nests in the world. I don't think so. Anyone has seen so many king cobra nests. Yes, I know how it works. I've seen them. I mean, I've sat there in front of a king cobra, female king cobra from morning 6 to evening 6, watching her build the nest. Yeah. So, yes, first she will accumulate about 30 to 40 centimeters of leaf litter. And then she would go inside, lay eggs, and with the weight of the eggs, that's when it becomes like a depression. So that becomes the egg chamber. And then she comes out, and the whole for maybe another 2 weeks, she will accumulate leaf litter, and she keeps piling it. So she would start around 9 o'clock in the morning, as soon as the sun rises, and she baths and she gets some energy. And takes frequent breaks until 5 in the evening she will work. So that is why from 40 centimeters, it goes up to 90 centimeters or 60 centimeters of leaf litter. So she keeps accumulating leaf litter whole day. And she will lie right on top of the the nest so that with her weight, it gets compressed. And during summer showers, and there's the chamber gets packed airtight, like an incubator. There's no gap in between. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So obviously it forms insulation. I'm curious, do we know of any, like if the biological activity in that leaf litter, say the breaking down bacteria, whatever it might be, is there any knowledge about whether there's actually heat being produced or energy being produced in that leaf litter that's helping to incubate anything like that? Just completely off the top of my head, but.
Oh, yeah, that's an interesting question. Even I wanted to answer, but unfortunately, I didn't do it. But I'm happy. I'm glad one of my friends in Himalayas, Uttarakhand, he's working on it. That's his PhD project. So maybe I can't talk about that. Or maybe we can wait for him to finish his project and publish the paper. And maybe you can interview him soon.
Yeah.
Yeah, that aspect.
That'd be excellent. No
clue. Yes, yes. I'm looking forward
to it. Approximately how many eggs will the female lay?
Anywhere between 20 to 43. 43 is the maximum I've counted in Western Ghats. But yes, 50 plus, 56 plus is the maximum numbers recorded in other places. So, yeah.
Yeah, and then
and
you,
I had,
you mentioned
100%
the
incubation.
Okay. And so you mentioned the female will sit on top of the nest. So she stays with the eggs the entire time that they're incubating them. Is that correct?
Perfect. So that's another difference between the Western Guard's lineage or one species here, where she will stay on the nest or guard the nest for about 30, 35 days after she lays eggs, and she'll then leaves. Right? But the Eastern Guards, that's in Mizoram or eastern part of India and all the way to Thailand, I think they stay much longer, giving protection
to the
nest.
So will those, do any of the king cobra species stay with the nest until the young hatch? Or do they all typically leave before they hatch?
Exactly. They leave before they hatch. I think the second lineage in the Mizoram and the eastern part of India, they leave exactly 1 week before they hatch. So when the female leaves, we can time it. Okay, now another 1 week, the babies are going to hatch or the hatching is going to hatch. So that's the perfect time. They leave just before they hatch.
Okay.
Right.
Gotcha. And then last question about the nests. Once the babies hatch, do they stay in the nest or around the nest for a time period, or they disperse very quickly?
I think they stay close to 7 to 10 days or maybe 2 weeks. I've seen the hatchlings shedding their skin inside the nest chamber, and then they emerge out. And they, till then, I think the yolk supports them, and because they need protection, they need to warm up, they need to change their skin. Everything happens inside the nest chamber, and then they leave. So they do stay inside the nest for some time, yes.
That's very interesting. It's very similar to rattlesnakes, you know. So most rattlesnakes, the babies will stay at the gestation site for about, let's say, 10 days until they have their first shed, and then typically they disperse. And actually, right here, the timber rattlesnakes where I live, they're giving birth right now. Actually, after we get off this episode, I'm running out into the field to a gestation site where we know that a female had just given birth. So we're going to try to catch some of these babies on film. But okay. Well, I have 1,000 questions. I could keep going, but for the sake of time, let's move on. We've talked about some of it throughout this conversation, but I do want to touch on your PhD work and the concept of these four species. So I guess the first thing I'd ask is, what was it, what drove you to think about this question? Is there more than one species of king cobra?
Yes, like you mentioned, and everybody else is a snake enthusiast, when you look at different pictures or different species, different populations, you go to different places and you capture one and see, wow, this looks different from this one, So that was my curiosity. And the second, I would say the first and foremost before this, when I got bitten by a king cobra, the antivenom which I had from Thailand didn't work. And somewhere we knew that the Thailand antivenom doesn't work on Indian king cobra. So that was a hint that they might be different species. So I was really looking forward to know exactly what their status is, whether they're different species or subspecies. What if they are, what is the genetic divergence? This will definitely help in conservation policies, right? Right now, the fourth species, the fourth lineage, is found in one of the largest island in Philippines, right? It's found only in that island. So that would be the most endangered king cobra species on Earth right now. If something goes wrong on that island, we might lose the species. So identifying the species is very, very important for conservation.
So we could do like a 2-hour podcast because you just dropped a huge bomb. So you've had a king cobra bite. So for the sake of time, we can't really talk about that in depth, but let's touch on it for a minute. What were you doing when you got that bite? And just tell us a little bit about that experience.
I was rescuing a king cobra. We had 3 king cobras at that one particular village. The male combat was happening. So I didn't find the female, but the 3 males were fighting. The male combat happening right in the middle of the village. So they called me. I caught the first one, put him in a bag. The second one, I put him in another bag. The third one, I didn't have a bag. I didn't have a snake bag. So I tried to put him in a small cobra bag, which is much, much tinier than the king cobra bag. So I tried to squeeze him into that small bag. When he realized something was happening, so he tried biting me through the bag. So it was just a nibble, just a scratch. That put me in hospital for almost 3 days, and I almost died. And I managed to survive.
What were the effects? You mentioned some nerve. Well, yeah, I'm glad you survived, obviously. How? So you mentioned the venom's primarily neurotoxic. What types of symptoms did you have? Were you experiencing some form of like paralysis? You know, what were you experiencing that almost caused you to lose your life?
Luckily, like I mentioned, I didn't give him enough chance to pump in entire venom or even get a deep fang deep into my my hand. So this was just a nibble that gave me a lot of swelling, burning sensation, pain, but luckily it didn't reach to the neurological symptom stage where, like you mentioned, the paralysis or ptosis, nothing happened. So it was just the local symptom. My entire arm swollen and a lot of pain. That's all I managed. I think I was very calm, and we used the polyvalent what we had, and we treated the snake bites symptomatically because we don't have antivenom. But I did try Thailand antivenom. It didn't work. It was I couldn't take it. There was allergy. My body wouldn't accept. So we had to stop in between.
Yeah. Well, that's a great story. Just the fact that your own king cobra bite is one of the things that propelled you to think about these animals as, the potential for different species. What an amazing story. So you mentioned, the obvious morphology differences that I called out being the color patterns and the banding patterns. Are there any other major morphological differences among the species, whether it be size or, anything else that's really obvious morphologically that you found?
Yeah, not much, but yes, the scale counts do differ, the head scales and your subcaudals, the tail scales, the below, the belly scales have some variation, but not big enough yet. Not much, not visually. Yeah. For a layman, I think these band patterns and that makes more sense than the color and other scale counts.
Yeah. And given your experience with your bite, that there's obviously differences among the species in the venom. Have you guys learned anything about how the venom varies among the species?
No, not yet. Like I mentioned earlier, that will be my future project. Very soon, I'm going to embark on that project. I'm going to collect the venom samples across Western Ghats, Southeast, and see how they vary. And accordingly, we will come up with the region-specific antivenom soon.
Great. And then the last component that I wanted to touch on with your PhD and the designation of these four species is the genetic component, which I'm assuming was probably the most important component in designating the species.
Yes.
So just talk to us a little bit about what you found looking at the genetics of these four species.
Well, I used about five genes, so the markers, like three nuclear and two mitochondrial, where I figured out the divergence between the Western Ghats and the Eastern Ghats and all the way to Philippines is anywhere between 2 to 6 percentage. Like, chimpanzee and human beings, we are like close to 1.8 or 2 percentage difference, right? So that makes we are two different species. But compared to other snakes, the genetic divergence is very, very shallow with king cobras. The other species, if you see some of the wine snakes or keelbacks, there'll be like anywhere between 12 to 15% divergence, right? But here it's a very, very shallow, but we still, based on the geographical distance, I could declare them as, or designate them as four different genus or four different species, not genus. Yeah, because nowhere in future they're going to meet. Because there is a lot of geographical barriers in between these lineages.
Mm-hmm.
So that is a very strong evidence.
Excellent.
That, yes, For example, the Luzon Island, there's no way he's going to move on to the other islands or interact with the third lineage, right? So if you see the Western Ghats and the Eastern Ghats in India, we have the Deccan Plateau, which separates them. It's a dry zone that the king cobras are not found there. I'm not sure whether eventually they will cross over and interbreed. So that way, they are two different lineages. So that was the strong evidence we
had. Great. Okay. Well, is there anything else that you wanted to mention about your PhD project and the designation of these four species before we move on?
Right now, I'm up to naming them. So because these are new species, at least two are new species, never named before. So I'll be giving them new names. And another two species, we will retain the existing names. So that's what I'm trying to do right now. That's my second paper. So I'm looking forward to publish that paper and work with IUCN or the regions, the populations, the government or the forest department, and tell them the importance of the king cobras and initiate better protective laws to conserve them in future. That's my plan.
Yeah. Great. Well, I'm on the executive committee for the snake specialist group. So feel free if we can be of assistance.
Sure. I will write to you, Chris. Thank you very much. Yeah.
And okay, great. Well, I like to take all of my guests and put them into a situation. So imagine I come down and we're out somewhere in the bush, in the jungle, and, you know, we just spent a day working with king cobras, and we're sitting around a campfire at night, maybe enjoying a cold beverage, and and you were just telling stories about our lives, and you're going to tell me your best snake story.
Yeah, out of 400 rescues, each one is unique and different. I have more, but I just mentioned maybe one. I had few guests from Sweden, so they had come and we were monitoring a mating pair. There were already three king cobra, male king cobras and one female. So that was too much for me to handle. And I was like surprised, wow, like three males, one female, a lot of action happening. So I placed all my volunteers, and my wife also was watching one female king cobra, and these guys were watching. And suddenly these guys were walking around and they said, "Gauri, we saw one more king cobra." I said, "Are you serious? That's going to be the fourth male." I said, "No, it's not possible." I mean, I didn't say it's not possible. I was surprised to know there are going to be five king cobras in that small village. So I was surprised and went looking for it, and I didn't find one. Then I said, "Like, guys, maybe you saw a big rat snake or some other snake. Maybe you're mistaken." So they were very sure. They said, "No, we did see a king cobra." And these guys went walking around. I came. There was a small kennel, and my wife was on the other side. I was on this side. I placed my hand on the trunk of the tree, and I was telling my wife that these guys told me that they saw a king cobra, but I don't think so. There could be one more male king cobra. And so I was telling her the entire sequence. And these guys came walking, and they said, "Gauri, what? Look up there." So where I kept my hand to my shoulder level, and there's a branch just across, and the whole king cobra, like 4 meter king cobra with the hood up, like just about 30 centimeters from my eye or from my head, I would say. And he was watching the whole time while I was talking to my wife, and he didn't strike me. And when they said, "Look up there," and I looked at him, so it was like 30 centimeters between my eye and the king cobra. And he was whole time, for a few minutes or a few seconds, he was watching, lying there very quietly, and didn't even strike. Then I just moved very gently. And so these guys were right. They saw the fourth one. The fourth one was right here on the branch where I was standing, above me. So that was like that close. I couldn't imagine your rattlesnake or a Russell Viper giving me that much time to relax and not striking me, right? Your rattlesnake would definitely would have striked by then.
Yeah, that's the time that you were very thankful that these are very kind of inquisitive, seemingly intelligent snakes.
Exactly. Yeah, this has happened many times to me, so I have more stories like that if you have time, but I would stop here.
Yeah, that's a great one. What an image. But and also, I think the episode following yours, I think it will be the one directly following this episode, will actually be with a biologist originally from Sweden. You may know him, Thomas Madsen, who's going to be, we're going to be talking about adders up in Scandinavia.
Oh,
so
okay.
Interesting Thomas that you're out with some Swedes.
Right? Madsen.
So, yeah. Madsen. Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, yes, anyways, yeah. So he'll be on very soon. Great. Well, I cannot stress this enough, but I really enjoyed this episode. Again, it's always been a real curiosity of mine, and I feel like I learned quite a bit, and I feel like now I need to get over to that part of the world and see one in the wild. So I may hit you up on that. Thank you so much, Gary, for spending some time with us today and teaching us so much about this amazing animal.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you for inviting me. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Great. And I just wanted to thank the audience and tell everybody to remember, snakes are animals too, and it's a privilege to see one in the wild.